What I'd like to do now is begin by looking at a little bit of the history of Buddhism. How did it begin and how it then spread throughout the world, so that we can get some context for our discussions. So it all began in 563 BC. A prince was born in Lumbini, which is in modern-day Nepal. His name was Prince Siddhartha, and his father was the king of the region. And when he was born, the wise man of the court made a prophecy to the king that this boy would either become a great ruler or a great spiritual leader. And so, of course, the king wanted the prince to follow in his footsteps, so he did everything in his power in his upbringing to lead him in the direction of becoming the next king. And so he protected him in the palace and provided everything he wanted to the prince. But then as the prince was growing up, he made some trips out of the palace and saw the harsh realities of life. He saw aging, sickness, death. And also he saw a wandering mendicant, someone who seemed to be very much at peace with themselves. In fact, this whole story of the Buddha is actually drawn on the wall over there in the corner. That whole section from at the back corner is the life story of the Buddha. And so I think the part what I'm talking about now is sort of towards the bottom, right at the back. You'll see some corpse and you'll see a wandering person and so forth. And then the prince decided he needed to find out the meaning of life and reality. And so he actually escaped from the palace at age 29. And he went on the search for the truth to life. And already at that time, of course, there were a lot of spiritual traditions, and so he went in search of some people that could help him. And he found some people practicing. In particular, they were following a sort of an ascetic type of practice, and in particular, they were engaging in meditation practice, like this shamatha practice, the deep absorption of the mind, just concentrating the mind deeper and deeper and deeper. Because it was felt then at that time that the way to liberation from suffering was, of course, to get rid of attachment. And one way it was considered to get rid of attachment is just develop these deep absorptions, this deep concentration. And in particular, it was felt that attachment to the body was one of the main problems, and so therefore to deny the body. So therefore, engaging in ascetic practices of not really eating. And so Prince Siddhartha engaged in these practices for 6 years, and he was at a point where he was just about to pass away from malnutrition. In fact, there's a very nice little drawing there you can see, I think a little bit to the right of the main drawing, him meditating, showing the ribs, the meditator, ribs. And so he's sort of almost on the point of death of malnutrition when he realized that this was an extreme path, that this was not the way to liberation. So he left his fellow practitioners and went out on his own in the search for truth. And what happened next, I'd like to read a little bit from a book called What Makes You Not a Buddhist, from Dzongtsa Kense. Some of you may have heard of him. And the way he describes it is very nice, so I'll read from his book. He says, "Through many years of contemplation and penance, Siddhartha remained steadfast in his determination to find the root cause of suffering and to ease his own suffering and the suffering of others. He headed to Magadha in the heart of India to continue his meditation. Along the way, he met a grass seller named Sotia, who offered him a handful of kusha grass. Siddhartha recognized this as an auspicious sign. In ancient Indian culture, kusha grass was considered a cleansing substance. Instead of continuing his journey, he decided to stop and meditate right there. He found a place to sit on the flat stones under a nearby ficus religiosa tree, using the kusha grass as a mat. Silently he vowed, "This body may rot, I may disintegrate into the dust, but until I find the answer, I will not rise." As Siddhartha sat in contemplation beneath the tree, he did not go unnoticed. Mara, the king of demons, heard Siddhartha's vow and sensed the strength of his resolve. Mara grew sleepless, for he knew that within Siddhartha existed the potential to throw his entire domain into chaos. Being a strategic warrior, he sent five of his most beautiful daughters to distract and seduce the prince. As the girls set out, they had full confidence in their seductive talents. But as they approached the meditating Siddhartha, their beauty began to vanish. They withered and aged, they grew warts, and a stench rose from their skin. Siddhartha did not stir. The dejected apsaras returned to their father, who was furious. "How dare anyone refuse his daughters?" In his rage, Mara summoned his retinue, a great army furnished with every imaginable weapon. Mara's army attacked in full force, but to their dismay, all the arrows, spears, stones, and catapults aimed at Siddhartha transformed into a rain of flowers as soon as they came within reach of their target. After many long hours of unsuccessful warfare, Mara and his army were exhausted and defeated. So again, I think there's a very nice drawing there towards the front on the back side where you see Prince Siddhartha meditating, and around him you see underneath the beautiful girls, and then above the demons firing arrows at him, trying to assault him. And then he says here, "Finally Mara came to Siddhartha and with all his diplomacy tried to talk him into giving up his quest. Siddhartha said that he could not give up after all these lifetimes of trying. Mara asked, 'How can we be so sure that you've been struggling for so long?' Siddhartha answered, 'I don't need validation. The earth is my witness.' And with this he touched the ground, the earth shook, and Mara evaporated into thin air. Thus Siddhartha found liberation and became a Buddha. He had discovered the path to end suffering at its very root, not only for himself, but for all people. The place of his final battle against Mara is now called Bodh Gaya, and the tree under which he sat is called the Bodhi tree. This is a story that Buddhist mothers have told their children for many generations." So again, very nicely drawn on the wall over there. Now, of course, we can accept this story literally. There was a demon, Mara, there was daughters, there was an army. But as we're going to see, beginning particularly tomorrow morning, is we can understand that the Mara, the daughters and the army are symbolic of inner demons. Inner demons that Prince Siddhartha overcame. And so he overcame these inner demons. And what those are, we'll talk about tomorrow morning. And he became a Buddha. He achieved enlightenment at age 35. So what is enlightenment? Enlightenment is a state completely free of all suffering and its causes. And it's also a state where all positive qualities have been fully developed. So when Prince Siddhartha achieved this goal of enlightenment, he became known as Shakyamuni Buddha. Buddha is a Sanskrit word, and literally it means the one who's completely awakened, the awakened one, someone who has eliminated all suffering and its causes, someone who's fully developed all the positive qualities. And then Shakyamuni, who we divide into two, Shakya is the group or clan of people that Prince Siddhartha grew up with. And Muni here has many meanings. Here it means someone who has a lot of capacity or strength. A lot of capacity or strength to help liberate others from suffering. So Shakyamuni Buddha is the completely awakened one from the Shakya clan who has the capacity to help liberate others from suffering. So he achieved enlightenment at age 35, and then he spent the next 45 years wandering around India, teaching people what he had discovered. And the very first teaching he gave was the Four Noble Truths in Sarnath, right next to Varanasi. And he sought out some of his spiritual, some of the people that he was meditating with before, because he felt that they were already spiritually advanced and they would probably easily understand what he had discovered. So he went out in search of these five ascetics that he was previously meditating with. He found them in Sarnath and he taught the Four Noble Truths. And that's, you see that right in the bottom corner at the front, you see the five ascetic practitioners there receiving the Four Noble Truths teaching from Shakyamuni Buddha. So the Four Noble Truths, of course, is the foundation of all Buddhist traditions. And so we're going to use these Four Noble Truths as the foundation for all of our discussions in this course. Now, so the Buddha taught 45 years and then passed away at age 80. Now, after the time of the Buddha, Buddhism started to spread more in India, and then it started to spread outside of India. And Buddhism spread through two languages. So initially, it spread through the Pali language into Sri Lanka first, and then it spread up through the northeast of India into Burma, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, so down through Southeast Asia. So in all of those Buddhist traditions now, when they go back to the original texts, they'll go back to the texts written in the Pali language. And so all of these traditions collectively now are called Theravada traditions. So in the Theravada traditions, then the goal of the spiritual practice is nirvana. And nirvana is liberation from suffering and its causes. It's when we become liberated from suffering and its causes, we achieve this goal of nirvana. And then also, Buddhism started to spread in India through the Sanskrit language. So again, in the Pali traditions, then the sort of the core teaching is the Four Noble Truths. And then Buddhism also started to spread in India through the Sanskrit language. And then at that time, it started to spread up through the northwest of India, over the Himalayas onto the Silk Route, and went across the Silk Route into China, Korea, Japan, down to Vietnam. And then also it spread over the Himalayas into Tibet. Now, and so in all of those traditions now, when they go back to the original text, they'll go back to the Sanskrit texts. And so all of those Buddhist traditions now collectively are called Mahayana traditions. And in these traditions, the goal of the spiritual path is enlightenment, to achieve the goal of enlightenment, to become Buddha. So in the Mahayana Sanskrit traditions, they distinguish between the goal of nirvana and enlightenment, that enlightenment is a further step. What the differences are and so forth, we'll talk about later. And so in this tradition, of course, they're based on the Four Noble Truths as well, but in these Sanskrit Mahayana traditions, a lot of the teachings are based on what's called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And we'll look at these types of teachings later in the course. So when Buddhism spread to Tibet, it spread at two times. Initially, Buddhism spread to Tibet in the 8th century. And it spread through great Indian master Padmasambhava. In fact, this statue on the end here, on the altar, is Padmasambhava. So he brought Buddhism to Tibet initially. And through his teachings, we have a school of Tibetan Buddhism being formed called the Nyingma School of Tibetan Buddhism. So in Tibetan Buddhism, we can talk about four schools. The first one that was formed is the Nyingma School of Tibetan Buddhism. Nyingma is a Tibetan word which literally means old school or original school. And the type of teachings that Padmasambhava brought into Tibet that formed the basis of the Nyingma School of Tibetan Buddhism is a system of practice called Dzogchen. And this Dzogchen system of practice is really primarily focused on the mind itself, so it's often called nature of the mind practice. And this was established around the 8th century. But then shortly afterwards, a king came to power in Tibet who didn't like Buddhism and tried to wipe out Buddhism in Tibet. So Buddhism sort of went underground for a couple of centuries. And then around the 10th, 11th century, some more Indian masters came across the Himalayas to revitalize Buddhism in Tibet around the 11th century. And through their efforts, we have the other three schools of Tibetan Buddhism slowly being formed. And the first of those is called the Kagyu School of Tibetan Buddhism. And the system of practice that was brought into Tibet through this Indian masters is called Mahamudra. And Mahamudra is very similar to Dzogchen, and it really is focusing on the mind, often called nature of the mind practice. So these two systems of practice are very similar. And then we have the third school of Tibetan Buddhism, Sakya School, coming from other great Indian masters, where they brought a system of practice in Tibet called Lamdre. Lamdre is a Tibetan word. Lam means path, dre means result. So Lamdre is talking about the path and the result. So it's a little bit different system of practice than Dzogchen and Mahamudra. And then, also in the 11th century, we have another great Indian master coming into Tibet, Lama Atisha. And he is right at the end of the other end of, with the red hat, at the other end of the altar here is Lama Atisha. And Lama Atisha brought two main systems of practice into Tibet. One called Lojong, or mind training, which is practiced across all Tibetan schools widely. And it's a system of practice, again, focusing on the mind, but in particular, the strength of Lojong practice is a little bit what I talked about earlier, is in Lojong practice, there are instructions on how to even see difficult situations as opportunities for practice. How to turn difficult situations not as problems or obstacles, but turn them into opportunities to be able to use them to develop ourselves more. So this is one of the big strengths of Lojong practice, called, sometimes translated in English as mind training. But also Lama Atisha brought another system of practice in Tibet called Lam Rim, which formed the basis of the fourth school of Tibetan Buddhism. Again, Lam Rim is a Tibetan word. Lam means path, Rim means stages. So Lam Rim is the stages of the path to enlightenment. So it sets out in a step-by-step way what practices we have to engage in to achieve the goal of enlightenment. So Lama Atisha brought this into Tibet, and then it was practiced widely, and then around the 14th century, another great Tibetan master, Lama Tsongkhapa, who this is a statue of, expanded on the Lam Rim teachings, and on the basis of that, we have the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism being formed. Now, Dalai Lama himself belongs to the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, but he's considered the spiritual head of all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. This centre is part of an organisation that belongs to the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism. These three schools, because they came later than the Nyingma school, collectively they're called the Sama schools. And Sama is a Tibetan word meaning new school. So Nyingma is the old school, the original school, because it came in the 8th century, and these came from the 11th century onwards, Sama schools. So we can talk about four schools of Tibetan Buddhism. So any questions about any of this?
Yeah, just when you mean schools, you mean like the way of the approach, not an actual school or a place to, like the approach and the way of studying the Buddhism.
Yeah, I mean, yes. These four are systems of practice. And so you'll find then, because they're a complete system of practice, then each one of them provides us a vehicle, a way to achieve enlightenment. And so it's actually very good that we've, even in Tibetan Buddhism, we've got four slightly different approaches. Then we can look at those and go, ooh, I think that one sort of resonates with my sort of way of thinking, and so I really can relate to that, so I'm going to use this approach. So then we can look at and evaluate and see which one sort of suits our disposition and temperament and perspective.
If the Dalai Lama belongs to the very last school,
yeah,
that came the latest,
yeah,
why is he then chosen to be the head of everybody?
Oh, I don't know about the history. But he himself, certainly the Dalai Lama, Even though technically he's here, he receives a lot of teachings from these schools as well. So some of the current Dalai Lama, some of his main teachers are actually coming from these other schools as well. So he's very much trying to promote all of the various schools and whatever, you know, to use whatever works for us. So he's very much putting a lot of effort into that. Because, you know, in any culture, you know, my system's better than your system. You know, whatever culture we're in, we always have this idea, mine is the best, yours is no good sort of thing. So, and even in Tibet, we had a little bit this sort of mentality. And so, of course, Dalai Lama's trying to sort of break down any sort of wrong way of thinking in that way. So he very much promotes all of those.
Is there any main differences in the...
Right, yeah. Okay, a brief answer, and then maybe I can talk a little bit more later. So, they, all of these, of course, come within the Mahayana Sanskrit tradition. So all of these approaches to practice, the goal is enlightenment. Same. To make it very simple, we can sort of, one way of distinguishing these approaches, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in a few days' time, is perspective. Perspective. For example, and we'll use an example to try and understand what I mean. Let's say we've got a window, and there's dirt on the window, and we want to clean the window. We can have at least two different perspectives. We can say, there's a dirty window, I need to put effort to produce a clean window. And usually that's the perspective we adopt. There's a dirty window, I'm going to put effort and make a clean window, produce a clean window. Completely valid. Equally well, we could go, actually, there's already a clean window there, all we need to do is remove the dirt to show the clean window that was already there. Also valid, isn't it? Isn't it? Isn't there a clean window there that's just covered by dirt? So which one is right and wrong? They're both right. It's perspective. And similarly in spiritual path, we can have different perspectives of the spiritual path. And we can adopt a perspective that works for us. So these two, well, let's start down here. This one, the Lam Rim perspective, is the one we normally use with the window. You know, there's a dirty window, I need to produce effort to produce a clean window. I'm here now, stuck, suffering, mental afflictions. I need to put effort to eliminate this suffering and achieve enlightenment. And that's probably the perspective. So perspective is where we are now and where do we have to go. So that's Lam Rim, stages of the path to enlightenment. So the perspective is looking forward from current point. This perspective. Dzogchen and Mahamudra, exact opposite. Like, there's already a clean window there. We just have to remove the dirt to show that there's a clean window already there. So Dzogchen and Mahamudra have that perspective. There's already an enlightened state within us. We just have to remove the dirt to find the enlightened state that's already there. And I haven't studied very much the Lamdre, but Sakya, I think, has a little bit the in-between perspective. Sort of have the perspective of the yogi, someone who's already sort of partway to enlightenment. So these are sort of the two opposite perspectives, and this is something in the middle. And this is a rough approximation. And each of these perspectives is valid, and we can use a perspective that works for us. Each of those perspectives has advantages and disadvantages. The disadvantage with this perspective is, oh God, I'm hopeless and that enlightenment is so far away. It's impossible that I can get there. Like, that window's so dirty, and there's no way I'm going to make that a clean window. So we get disheartened. But then this perspective is the opposite. There's already a clean window there. I don't need to do anything. And so we don't clean the dirt because it's already clean. I'm already enlightened. I don't need to do anything. and we don't do anything. So both of them have advantages and disadvantages. So we as an individual can adopt a perspective that works for us, and we can even have a little bit of a combination if we want. So that's just different perspectives. So that's a very gross simplification of that, but that's sort of one way of looking at the differences here. Any other questions about any of this?
So do these four schools have their own temples, have their own way of worshipping, rituals, everything?
Well, worship, I wouldn't use that word, but yes, they have their own practices. Each one of those is a complete system of practice. So one general recommendation is, for us as an individual, is within all of this, find a system of practice, and each one of them has a complete system. Find a system of practice that resonates with you, that you relate to, and that you find you can work with, and stick with that. Because it's a complete system that's been developed, tried and tested for centuries, fine-tuned. So it's an effective vehicle. If we sort of do a bit of window shopping and dabbling and go, oh, I like this thing from here, I like this from the Thai tradition, I like a bit of this Kalug stuff, and we sort of put it all together, oh, I like a bit of this other stuff from these other traditions, we stick it all together, mix it up, and then we go, oh, actually, nothing much is happening here. And it's because, if we do that, because of the different perspectives, often these practices actually don't fit together well, and sometimes they even work against each other because of the different perspectives. So what is not generally recommended is to do that. A bit of this, bit of this, bit of this, put it all together, mix it up and see what happens. It's not probably going to be very effective, and it could be counterproductive. You may find one practice actually works against another because of the perspective. So the general advice is shop around, and if you find one of these systems really resonates with you, work within that system. Then, if we know that system very well, and we start to get into it, we have a very good understanding, and we start to move along that, then, as we progress, it can be helpful to look a little bit outside the tradition to broaden the perspective. You know, like if we decide that this perspective works for us, and we get to know it very well and start practicing it well, then we can look at this perspective and maybe it helps us in this approach because we have a more broader perspective. But to mix and match as a beginner really doesn't work. It really is. Often it creates a lot of confusion and we don't really progress because we haven't got an integrated approach. Okay. Right. What I'd like to do now then... first... The Four Noble Truths is the foundation of all Buddhist traditions, Theravada Mahayana. So that's what we're going to use for the next 4 days in our class. We're going to look at the Four Noble Truths. Then on day 5 and 6, we're going to look at how the Mahayana traditions build on the Four Noble Truths through these perfection of wisdom teachings, how that builds on top of the Four Noble Truths. So we'll look at the Mahayana Sanskrit traditions, day 5 and 6. And then what we'll do on day 7, the last teaching day, is we'll look at this Lam Rim system of practice, how Lam Rim is structured, that vehicle of how we can do all of these various practices in a very methodical, structured way. Because this centre, again, is part of the Galup school. So we'll spend a day looking at the Lam Rim system, how they package everything together. And then, of course, day 8 and 9 are meditation days. So that's going to be the format of what we do in the coming days. So any last questions on that? Otherwise, I'd like to now give a brief introduction into the Four Noble Truths, because that's going to be our framework.
Is said before, the practice meditation thing. Say something about the traditional or religious environment in India or in Tibet. What came before Buddhism?
What was at the time of what was in India at the time of Prince Siddhartha already? Yeah, there are many, many traditions, and as I briefly mentioned, is many of these traditions had the idea of some sort of moksha, some sort of liberation from suffering. But many of them felt the way to achieve that was through samadhi practice, through concentration practice only. So they would go into these deep absorptions. And because it was felt, of course, understood that craving and attachment was the main problem. And if you go into these deep absorptions, certainly attachment really subsides. And they felt that these deep absorptions was eliminating attachment, but it wasn't. It was just through the power of the absorption, attachment was subdued. And part of that were ascetic practices as well. And Prince Siddhartha understood that even though these absorption practices can be helpful, we need to do more than that to achieve liberation. We need to get rid of attachment and aversion and all these mental afflictions. And concentration itself is not enough. To overcome that, what he discovered was that the reason we have these craving, attachment and other mental afflictions is because we have a distorted view of reality. And to overcome the distorted view of reality, we need to engage in the wisdom practice or the vipassana practice. So that's what he added to the samadhi practice, the concentration practice. On that basis, he went into the vipassana practice, the wisdom practice, to realize the nature of reality, to overcome the mental afflictions and achieve liberation. But again, we're going to talk a lot about that in the coming days. Right.
Before you move on, just out of curiosity, you didn't talk about the Vajrayana.
It's coming. I'll talk about that in a few days' time.
But it's a different vehicle, right? Different.
Yes and no. But I'll explain that in a few days' time. So don't worry. So Vajrayana or Tantra, we'll talk about it. But first, before we talk about that, we need some foundation. Otherwise, it won't really make any sense to talk about it. So I'm going to introduce the foundations, and then we'll talk about it. Okay. Now, in explaining the Four Noble Truths, and also in general in Buddhism, when some new concept is introduced, to try to better understand the concept, often some simple analogy is used to try to understand what we mean by this concept. And so here in the Four Noble Truths, often the analogy that's used is the analogy of some sort of physical illness. And when we have some sort of physical illness, then there are certain steps we go through to overcome that physical illness. And in general, of course, if we have some physical illness, one of the first things we do, of course, is we go to the doctor. Why? Because we believe that the doctor is qualified to help us. So what is the first thing that a doctor would do for us?
Medicine.
What's the word for that?
Diagnosis.
And in the diagnosis process, usually there are two steps. First, they would maybe do all sorts of checks and tests. They would look at our symptoms, you know, what symptoms are you displaying? So maybe they do a blood test, check your heart and all temperature and so forth. And then when they gather all this information, then they look at that and they try to work out what's the underlying cause that's producing these symptoms. So that's the diagnosis. What comes after diagnosis?
Medicine.
Before that. What becomes before the medicine? prognosis. So prognosis is that the doctor has decided that we have such and such an illness, and that the prognosis is we can cure that, or sorry, we can't cure that. So the prognosis is, what can we do about that? So that comes next. And the analogy here is of a curable illness, an illness that we can cure. So the prognosis would be, first the symptoms, then the doctor says, I believe you have such and such an illness. Prognosis, we can cure that. And then, of course, comes the cure. So these are the steps we go through to overcome physical illness. These three steps, or we can break it into four steps here. So similarly, the Buddha is like our doctor. And so that's what we have, the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha gives us his diagnosis. What is our human condition? And the first noble truth is, you know, what are the symptoms? What condition do we find ourselves in? First noble truth is truth of suffering. Based on the human condition. This is a classic example of how terminology creates confusion. Because here we are describing the human condition according to Buddhism. And this word suffering creates confusion. Because when we see the word suffering in English, for us, that means some sort of unpleasant, painful, physical or mental experience. Whereas the original word the Buddha used to describe this was dukkha. What is the human condition? Is dukkha. And dukkha has a much broader meaning than merely this word suffering as we usually know it. Because often, when it's translated like this, you'll often hear people, when they're describing the Four Noble Truths, you'll hear them say things like, according to Buddhism, all life is suffering. And when we hear that, we go, ooh, that doesn't sound right. Because we think what that person's saying is that all life, according to Buddhism, is painful, unpleasant experiences. This is, of course, not what the Buddha was saying. What he was saying is that the human condition is dukkha. To understand what that really means, we can talk about three levels of dukkha. The first is the dukkha of suffering. And here the word suffering does mean our unpleasant, painful experiences. So we can understand that part of the human condition is sometimes, in fact, we do have unpleasant, painful, physical, mental experiences. So that is pretty obvious to us. Then the next level of dukkha is called the dukkha of change. And this is talking about our pleasant experiences. So why would the Buddha use the word change to describe our pleasant experiences?
Because they don't last.
Because they don't last. As we saw earlier, normally we equate pleasant experiences with happiness. And so we have craving and attachment, And we're hoping that our pleasant experiences will give us some sort of more lasting happiness. So the Buddha used the word change to describe them to really get us to understand our pleasant experiences are transient. They're stimulus-based experiences. They will come to an end. And don't crave and grasp onto them, because if we do, we're just going to induce a lot of unnecessary suffering. And also here, to understand that our pleasant experiences are not really even in the nature of happiness. Because if something is in the nature of happiness, it would mean the more we engaged in it, the more happy we should become. But we know from our own experience, if we overindulge in pleasant experiences, we don't become more happy. We often end up with a lot of suffering. The classic example that's often given here in the text is, imagine you're in a cold room, you're cold, you look outside, it's nice and sunny, you go, oh, so nice and sunny out there. And we go outside and go, oh, that's so nice and sunny. If that pleasant experience was in the nature of happiness, it would mean the longer we sat in the sun, the more happy we should become. But we know from our own experience, if we sit out there too long, we get dehydrated, maybe sunburnt, and then we start to really suffer. And then we look in the room and go, oh, so nice and cool in the room. So what we can understand is that our pleasant experiences are relative experiences. Relative to a previous state, they're an improvement. But if we overindulge in them, they themselves can turn into suffering. So if we can understand this here, we can understand that not to crave and have attachment for pleasant experiences, because that will induce suffering, and not to hope that they're going to give us some sort of lasting happiness, because they won't. They'll just create more suffering. So if we can understand pleasant experiences for what they are, then we can simply enjoy them while we have them. If we don't have them, no problem. But underlying both our pleasant and unpleasant experiences, there's something deeper going on in the human condition. And that is what's called all-pervasive dukkha. So all-pervasive means everywhere. So all-pervasive dukkha is the fact that there's nowhere we can go or be and be completely free of the potential for suffering. That our life is pervaded by a potential for suffering, regardless of what's going on. And so at the deepest level, this is how we are to understand the first noble truth of dukkha, that our life is pervaded by the potential for suffering. And so, to avoid this confusion of translating it as suffering, some translators translate this as unsatisfactory. So if someone were to say to you, according to Buddhism, all life is unsatisfactory, then we go, let me think about that. Yes? Unpleasant experiences, definitely unsatisfactory. Pleasant experiences, yes, unsatisfactory in terms of they don't last. And why is our life unsatisfactory at the deepest level? Because there's always a potential for some sort of suffering to arise in our life. So this is another way of understanding dukkha. So this is the first noble truth, the basic human condition. Any questions about this? Sorry?
Are the unpleasant experiences not temporal?
Exactly, as well. So we can apply the same thing to our unpleasant experiences, in that if there's nothing we can do about them, we can go, this too shall pass, and not have the aversion. Exactly. That can be also helpful when we're faced with unpleasant experiences, because often we go, oh, it's so unpleasant, I'm stuck here, it's never going to change. And then, of course, we get overwhelmed. And if we can do something about it, as Shanti Davis says in the back corner there, fix it. If you can't, this too shall pass. It's impermanent. It's transient. Anything else? Okay. Let's now go then to the second noble truth. So remember, the analogy is what is the underlying cause? What's the underlying illness that's causing the symptoms? So why are we stuck in this state of dukkha? What's the cause? So the second noble truth is the cause or origin of dukkha or suffering, in Sanskrit, samudaya. So here, when the Buddha taught four noble truths, and he taught the second noble truth, what is the underlying cause or origin? Why are we stuck in this unsatisfactory state of dukkha? And here, the Buddha identified two things. Mental afflictions and actions. Mental affliction is a translation of a Sanskrit word, klesha. And a mental affliction is anything in our mind that agitates the mind. So some examples of mental afflictions, of course, are anger, craving, jealousy, anxiety, and so forth. Anything that disturbs and agitates the mind is a mental affliction. And these mental afflictions are what's driving our behavior or our actions. And the Sanskrit word for action is karma. And the Buddhist assertion is that every action we do based on a mental affliction has a result, has a consequence. Mental afflictions, we can list many. We can make a list of hundreds of them if we wanted to. Often in Buddhism, you'll hear sometimes the six root mental afflictions or primary mental afflictions. And if we condense that down, we can talk about the three poisons. The three poisons are three things that poison or contaminate our mind. Two of them we've already looked at briefly: attachment, aversion. Where do attachment and aversion come from? I briefly mentioned a distorted view of reality. In Buddhism, that's often using the word ignorance. So when we see the word ignorance here, it means we're ignorant of the nature of reality. We misunderstand how we exist and the world around us exists. So the three poisons are that ignorance is our distorted view of reality, and that leads to attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things, and then all other mental afflictions come out of one of these or a combination of them. So these are the three core mental afflictions. And of course, we're going to be looking at these in a lot of detail. So tomorrow in particular, we're going to look at attachment and aversion, and in particular, a form of aversion that's very destructive called anger. We'll be looking at that tomorrow. And then this ignorance, our distorted view of reality, we'll be looking at in more detail some days down the track when we look about the topic of the nature of reality. So the Buddhist assertion, of course, is that if we can eliminate this ignorance by realizing the nature of reality, we can eliminate these mental afflictions, our actions, and then we can achieve liberation, which of course is the prognosis. So the prognosis, the third noble truth, is the fact that we can cure ourselves of dukkha. We can achieve liberation from dukkha. But before that, any questions about this second noble truth?
Yeah,
Can you explain again, connect between the mental afflictions and the actions,
okay.
the klesha and the karma?
Yeah. So mental affliction are these, and anxiety, anything that agitates the mind. That is what's driving our behavior. And every action we do, motivated by a mental affliction, has a result. And that process of how that action gives the result is this. And we're going to look at that tomorrow afternoon in detail.
Now, it's just karma, not necessarily good or bad karma. Also, if it was not a negative affliction.
What we need to understand is mental afflictions don't necessarily lead to non-virtuous, harmful behavior. Even when we do something good for others, that is still based on a mental affliction of ignorance. So both beneficial and harmful actions are motivated by mental afflictions. So they have a result. What those results are, we'll talk about tomorrow afternoon in detail. Anything else here? Yeah.
The root meaning of the word dukkha, because you said that...
Oh, okay. So the etymology of this, and I think here particularly for modern Hindi speakers, I think the word dukkha in Hindi now means some sort of sadness or something, I think.
Sadness.
Yeah, so I think this is a little bit different than the original etymology. And there are a couple of different etymologies that I've seen from the early uses of the word dukkha. And one etymology of the word dukkha, or one analogy that's often given for what that word dukkha means, is the example of you have a wheel, and then in the wheel have an axle in the wheel, and the wheel is not really turning very well. There's something not quite right. So that's one etymology of this word dukkha. There's something's not quite right. So that's one understanding of dukkha. But again, I haven't come across any word in English that really encompasses the entire meaning of the word dukkha. So I prefer to present dukkha and try to understand what that word dukkha means. Because really this word, I find often people get a big misunderstanding of what Buddhism is saying here. Because we associate this with simply unpleasant experiences. Right, let's move on. And so the prognosis, the Buddhist prognosis, of course, is that we can be cured of dukkha by eliminating the cause, by eliminating the mental afflictions. So the third noble truth is the truth of cessation, the ceasing or ending of suffering and its causes, in Sanskrit, nirodha. So here, of course, we're talking about achieving a healthy state, a state completely free of all suffering and its causes. Now, the Buddhist assertion is that we are stuck in this state, not just in this life, but life after life after life. We're stuck in this state of dukkha. And this cycling, life after life, in this state, in Sanskrit, is called samsara. Samsara in Sanskrit, sam is like an intensifier, meaning thoroughly. And sara is coming from the root meaning to go. So it means to thoroughly go, to go around and around and around and around and round, stuck in this state of dukkha. This third noble truth, the cessation or ending of suffering, if we achieve this healthy state, we transcend samsara and we achieve the state of nirvana. So nirvana is a state completely free of dukkha and the causes and mental afflictions. So what we need to understand is samsara and nirvana are not places. This is not samsara. And when we achieve liberation, we don't end up in a place over the hill there, in a place called Nirvana. These are not places, they are states of mind. If our mind has mental afflictions, we're stuck in samsara. If we've eliminated all mental afflictions, we are in a state of Nirvana. So this is the third noble truth, the fact that we can achieve this healthy state of Nirvana by eliminating the causes of dukkha, the mental afflictions, particularly this ignorance. And then, of course, the last one is the cure. What's the medicine? How do we achieve this state? And that is truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. In Sanskrit, marga. So these are the practices, the things we need to do to achieve this goal of nirvana, to overcome a state, this cycle of existence called samsara. So these are the Four Noble Truths, and just a brief introduction into them. So of course we're going to go into a lot of detail here in the coming days, but is there any questions about the sort of the overall structure?
Are they uniquely Buddhist? I mean, did the Buddha take any influences from the Hindu society at the time? Or?
Well, of course, he was doing these ascetic practices and doing a lot of samadhi practice with that. So, of course, there are a lot of overlap there. But maybe what is a little bit more unique is this wisdom, the vipassana, the insight. Of course. The question can arise, do we have to be a Buddhist to achieve nirvana? And of course the answer is no. But the Buddhist assertion is that if we want to achieve nirvana, we need to have a direct insight into the nature of reality. If we can gain that through any other method apart from Buddhism, then we can achieve nirvana. The question is, can we get that direct, correct insight into reality or not? That's the key factor.
I keep hearing the word ascetic, and I'm sorry if everybody else knows what it means, but I'm not
ascetic sure. Means to it's really a practice of denial, particularly often with ascetic practices, denying the body, like not like fasting all the time. And so the Buddha was doing this because it was felt that craving and attachment to the body was one of the main things locking us into samsara at that time, and so the practice was to deny the body by not eating.
And that applied also to emotions, like you were saying before, to push them down rather than to look at them? Or was it mainly just focused on the body?
No, I mean, I think in that time the ascetic practices was really being quite harsh on the body, not having craving and attachment, and involved some other more extreme practices than just fasting as well. Yes. So this is I'm going to start to briefly touch on this topic this afternoon when we talk about the mind. And then, of course, as we go along, what we're going to see, and particularly to answer that at a more deeper level, we have to really look at this nature of reality. What is the nature of reality? But a simple short answer now, of course, is that if we don't look after the body, then of course we can't develop our mind. So we're not talking here about forgetting about the body, ignoring the body. That's not going to work. So yes, of course we need to take care of the body. But the Buddhist assertion is that to achieve liberation, we need to develop our mind. But more will come in the coming days.
I was here, but when you talk about enlightenment, so where is enlightenment in the reality?
So this is going to come later. At the moment, we're talking about the Four Noble Truths, and the goal of the Four Noble Truths is nirvana. And what we saw briefly earlier is in the Mahayana traditions, they talk about this enlightenment. And from a Mahayana perspective, that's a further step. But to understand what that is and how, what's the difference between nirvana and enlightenment, I have to introduce some other ideas first. But we definitely will answer that question in the coming days. But the brief answer now is that to achieve enlightenment, we need this as a basis, and then we need to do something extra. And what that is, we're going to talk about.
But before you talked about another happiness, where is happiness? Is nirvana? You talked about genuine?
Yeah, genuine happiness is here.
Okay.
And then, of course, by default, also enlightenment.
Okay. If cure is the path, then would the destination be nirvana?
Yeah, the destination is nirvana. Yes, that's correct. Correct.
And mental affliction and delusion are interchangeable.
The word mental affliction, of course, is coming from the Sanskrit word klesha. And klesha is defined as anything that agitates the mind. And so that's translated into English, you'll find, in a number of different ways. Personally, I prefer mental afflictions, because that's, I think, most close with the etymology of the word klesha. The idea of agitation, disturbing, you know, something that afflicts the mind. Sometimes the word klesha is translated as disturbing emotions, which can be a bit misleading because not all kleshas are emotions. So when we see the word disturbing emotion, maybe we get the idea we're only talking about emotions, but we're not just talking about emotions, we're talking about any agitated state of mind that afflicts the mind. And then there's delusion, is sometimes used to translate that. Also, you'll see a number of different words. But personally, I like the word mental affliction because I think it's most close to the original meaning of the Sanskrit word of afflicting the mind, disturbing the mind. Conflict.
And affliction.
Conflict. What do you mean by conflict?
Conflict of thoughts.
Conflict. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what you mean by conflict.
Conflict of the thoughts, I mean, that disturbs us.
I think isn't conflict a result of these mental afflictions? We enter into some sort of conflict because we have them, maybe. And conflict often involves some sort of behavior or action. So here, of course, we're only talking about states of mind, which can lead to various sorts of behaviors and so forth, of course.
Is there a difference between nirvana and enlightenment?
Again, from a Mahayana perspective, from the Sanskrit tradition, yes, that nirvana is a stepping stone to enlightenment. What that difference is and how to move there, we're going to talk about. It's coming later in the course. I have to bring in some other ideas first and then we'll talk about that, so that's coming. Okay. What I'd like to do now, last presentation before we go to lunch, is I briefly indicated before that actually, you know, when we have some unpleasant suffering experience, often we just develop aversion to that, and all that does is magnifies our suffering. Whereas actually, suffering has qualities in terms of we can learn from suffering. That doesn't mean, of course, we need to go and search out suffering, but it means that if we are suffering, we can see that difficult situation as a problem and just develop aversion and suffer more, or we can see it as an opportunity to develop. So I'd like to talk about five ways in which we can see suffering as an opportunity and learn from that. And as I briefly mentioned already, generally, if our life is sort of going okay, We sort of float along and we don't really develop as a person. There's no incentive to do something. It's only when we're faced with some very difficult situation that challenges us do we then look at our worldview and look at how what is life about and can we overcome this suffering or not. So if we encounter suffering, that can really help us to understand what is that suffering and where is it coming from and can we do something about it. So actually it can help us to understand that the real cause of suffering is within ourselves, our mental afflictions, and then from that we can develop a wish to be free of that, which of course is this renunciation that we talked about. So if we're encountering suffering and we reflect on that, it can lead us to developing, through understanding the source of suffering is the mental afflictions, it can lead us to developing this aspiration to be liberated from suffering, which is the entry point to the Buddhist spiritual path. And then, of course, another quality is and very much related to the first point is it dispels arrogance. Here, arrogance meaning, I'm okay, everything's fine, I don't need to do anything. So these two are more or less the same thing, is to dispel the idea that everything's okay, I don't need to do anything. Because it really challenges us. You know, again, if things are going okay in our life, not too many harsh sufferings, we think, oh, it's okay, I'm all right. Question? Yeah. So remember, this is an example of not only how terminology creates confusion, but actually it's an example of the early translators into English not translating the word well. Because the Sanskrit word here is nisarana. And the Tibetan word is ne chum. And Tibetan, when Buddhism came to Tibet, there was no written language. And so the written language of Tibet was developed for Buddhism. So therefore, the terminology in Tibetan is also usually very precise, based on the Sanskrit. So the word nisarana means out, ni means out, sarana means to move out. To move out of our current state. And ne chum, ne means definite, and chum means to emerge. So it's the mind that definitely wants to emerge from this state of dukkha to liberation. So both of these literally mean the wish for liberation. Whereas renunciation really doesn't have that connotation. It really only has the idea of renouncing or giving up the eight worldly concerns, giving up the idea that happiness is to be found out there. So it's actually not even a very good translation for these terms, but someone early on, years ago, decided that was a good word and sort of stuck, and so now it's commonly used, but it can be very misleading. A better word here would mean something like the wish for liberation. Aspiration for liberation, yeah. Would be a better word to translate these.
How is that?
So this concept just telling us that when we suffer, we want to be in a place without suffering.
But we can only develop this if we correctly understand what is suffering and where is it coming from. Just to wish to be free of suffering is not this. Because now we suffer and we want to be free of it, don't we? Don't we? But just wanting to be free of suffering is of no help because we don't know, well, okay, I want to be free of suffering. Well, how do I do that? We don't know. We just want hope that we can be free of suffering. So to develop this, we need to develop an understanding of what do we really mean by suffering and what are its causes And can we eliminate those causes? Unless we go through those, which is the first couple of noble truths, we're never going to develop this. We're just going to have a wish, I want to be free of suffering, but it's not going to help.
Because I know that, like, we are intuitively going away from suffering.
We want to go away from suffering, yes.
No, but that's what we do.
I don't know. Are we having any less suffering now than 10 years ago? Are we actually moving more and more away from suffering? If we really are, then I would say continue doing what you're doing. If you're really having less and less suffering in your life, continue doing what you're doing, because it's obviously working. But I think in general, we don't. Sometimes we have less suffering, sometimes more, up and down, up and down, up and down. So if that's the case, then maybe our strategy is not very effective if we're not really having less suffering in our life. Okay.
These are the five qualities of eliminating suffering.
No, the five qualities of how we can learn from our suffering experiences, how we can turn our suffering experiences into an opportunity. You know, that we can develop this and have this. So let me just finish here and then maybe some more questions, because we're running out of time. And so, of course, if we're suffering, then we can relate to others better who suffer, because we have personal experience of that. So that can lead us to having compassion for others, because based on our own suffering, we know we can see how they're suffering and we can develop compassion for them. And then also, what we can do is we can understand that actually suffering comes from very harmful behaviour. So then if we're suffering, we can understand, or that can motivate us to avoid harmful, non-virtuous behaviour. And of course, the flip side of that is that it would also motivate us to engage in beneficial, helpful behaviour. Harmful behaviour, harmful, non-virtuous behaviour. So these are five ways in which we can... five qualities of suffering in terms of how we can learn if we suffer, how we can have that suffering experience as a way of learning and improving and as an opportunity to develop as a person in these five ways.
And it shows us that suffering is necessary for us to...
Right, good one. So as I mentioned before, the reality is many people only go into a spiritual path if we've had some difficult thing in our life happen. Studies show that actually whatever worldview we come up with by early 20s, we're more or less stuck with that. For better, for worse, no matter how dysfunctional it is, we've sort of come up with some sort of worldview by our early 20s. This is modern studies, not Buddhist thinking. Early modern studies show that whatever worldview we come up with by early 20s, We sort of stuck with it, unless something big comes our way. And studies also show it's only when we then, late 40s, early 50s, that we start to think about our worldview, because maybe our career's finished, family's gone, we have more time, and then we've had a lot of experience and then in life, and then maybe we start to question that worldview. But between that, unless we have some very difficult thing in our life happen, often we don't change that. No matter how dysfunctional it is, we're comfortable with that. Okay, I'm suffering, but I sort of know how to get around that, and you know, and it's the expression, better the devil you know than the one you don't. So there's no real motivation to challenge our worldview that we've established by early 20s, unless And that's often the case, is that we have some traumatic event that challenges that directly and forces us to look at our worldview. I'm not saying we have to have that to change our worldview, but that's often the case. There's not enough stimulus or motivation to challenge, because challenging our worldview is a big thing, you know, because to let go of that worldview, to form a new worldview, there's a period there where we're sort of like, we've let go of that, but we haven't really got some replacement. So it's a big thing. It's not something that we can just do like that.
Exactly like what you said before, that we can look for unpleasant things to improve our development.
Yeah, but at our level, but at our level, I wouldn't recommend that, because we often have enough unpleasant things coming our way. If we add more, we just get overwhelmed. And if we get overwhelmed, there's no way we can see this as an opportunity, because we're just completely overwhelmed. So, you know, a little dose of suffering can, and we face that. We don't need to go look for it. I mean, to be honest, we encounter that. Okay, we've run out of time there, so let's finish there. Now, as I mentioned last night, we're going to be discussing these questions or these topics in discussion groups each day from 2 to 3. And so we're going to break up into small groups, and we're going to have, based on the number of people in this class, we're going to have 12 groups. So there's going to be 6 or 7 in a group, which I think is a good number. So what I'll get you to do is to number off a number. Remember your number, don't forget it. And then I'll tell you where you're going to go for the discussion groups, because we're going to go sort of outside, unless, of course, it's raining, and then we have an alternate place. So what we're going to do, like the introduction, we're just going to do this, numbering off from 1 up to 12. And remember your number. So again, lucky first. So 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, if the weather is okay, not raining, then we can, I think it's good to be outside. So group 1 to 4, so group 1, 2, 3 and 4, you can go on the roof here. There's undercover area and also outside area. So to get on the roof, you have to go in the back of the building here and go right up to the top, and then there's a door over there. You can go out onto the roof, sit on the roof. Make sure you keep the door closed, otherwise the monkeys get in and make a bit of a mess. So group 1 to 4 up there, if it's raining, then there is a covered area you can sit under, or if you don't prefer to do that, you can come in here into the main gompa. So group 1 to 4 on the roof, or in here if it's bad weather. Group 5 and 6, over the back here there's two long green tables in the open, in the back corner. So group 5 and 6 on those two tables if it's okay. If it's raining, group 5 and 6 inside the dining room is your alternate. Group 7, 8, 9 will be underneath this green roof here. There's lots of tables under the green roof. So that's 7, 8, 9 under there. And I think even if it's raining, you can stay there. If it's really bad, you can also either go into the dining room or come in here. If you don't want to stay outside there if it's raining, but generally it's okay even to stay there if it's a bit of rain. And then group 10, 11, 12, where you go is, if you go past the dining room and then above the kitchen, there's a little roof area with tables and chairs. That's where you'll be. So behind the dining room, above the kitchen, group 10, 11, 12. If it's raining, then go into the Medicine Buddha Gompa. That's the upstairs room there. Next to that, there's an upstairs room above the dining room. So that's group 10, 11, 12. Is that clear? Okay. Now, questions. What I'll do each day is give some sample questions to use as a basis to begin your discussions. So I've got three questions here that you can look at today. The first question is, and this goes on to talk about these eight worldly concerns we looked at earlier this morning. If we give up the eight worldly concerns, if we give up the eight worldly concerns, will we be disadvantaged? Well, I think there'll be other people in your group that have the question. So I think not everyone needs to write. So if you have difficulty writing, leave it out. And I'm sure there'll be a few people in your group that have the questions.
Okay.
Then it's easy.
Can you complete the question?
Yeah. If we give up the eight worldly concerns, will we be disadvantaged? Meaning, if we give up those eight worldly concerns, will we face more difficulties in our life because of that? So that's the first question. The second question is about this word dukkha, the first noble truth. The question is, what did the Buddha mean by the word dukkha? What did the Buddha mean by the word dukkha? That our human condition is dukkha. What did he mean by that? One way of translating the word dukkha, as I mentioned, is sometimes it's translated as unsatisfactory. So the second part of the second question is, do you think that our pleasurable experiences are unsatisfactory? Because that's what it seems to be saying. Do you think that our pleasurable experiences are unsatisfactory? Do you think that our pleasurable experiences are unsatisfactory? Third question, we talked a little bit about this idea of genuine happiness and that we can be liberated from suffering. So the first part of the third question is there anything in our life that can give us lasting happiness? Is there anything in our life that can give us lasting happiness? And the second part of the third question is, do you think that we could ever be completely free of suffering? Do you think that we could ever be completely free of suffering? Or is that just some sort of crazy idea? Do you think that we could ever be completely free of suffering? So at 2 o'clock when the gong goes, then just go to your discussion group areas. Use these as a basis for your discussions. You don't have to try and answer all three, or if you've covered all three and you still have time left, you can discuss any other material relevant to what we've discussed this morning. Two other things before you run off for lunch. One is, of course, at 3 o'clock when the gong goes, please go back into silence and have a cup of tea, your tea break, because the tendency can be in these discussion groups to keep talking, and then, of course, you miss out on your tea break, and then maybe someone will come around and tell you to stop. So make sure at 3 o'clock you finish, go back into silence, have a cup of tea, have a break, and then if there are any questions in your discussion group that you couldn't answer or raised more questions, bring them back to class, because at 3:30 every day I'll start by asking if there's any questions from discussion group anyone would like to bring up. So bring them back to class, and then we'll see you back at 3:30.